In this part of Focus 580, we're doing a show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do it every other month on a Monday. And the guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. In his practice, he sees people of all ages, adults, kids, people with a variety of health concerns. And so when he is here on this program, we throw the thing open to whatever questions that you have. And I know that he will do his best to help you out. If you have some concerns you'd like to discuss, you can do that, and it can be for yourself or someone in your family. We do these programs in the hope that it will add to your health knowledge. It will give you a place to start. And then if you have concerns, obviously you need to take them up with somebody who can see you, because the one shortcoming we have on the program is that the doctor cannot see you, so we can't really do a diagnosis over the phone. However, as I said, I know he'd do his best to help you out. And so if you have a question, you are welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455, 333-9455, or WILL, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Very good to have you with us again. Thanks for
being here. Thank you, David.
I don't know if there's anything in particular that you would like to talk about, just to start us off here. One thing maybe I thought that I would ask you about, because it has now been in the news, is new recommendations about vaccinations for meningitis.
Yes. The recommendations in the past have been primarily geared toward young adults in a large group setting. So traditionally, military recruits in barrack situations, and also incoming college students in dorm settings have been the most commonly recommended groups to consider meningitis immunizations.
Hmm. And now, though, I think that you know, for example, for a long, long time here on the program, we have a pediatrician who's on every month, and occasionally I've sort of asked him about that. And when it's in the news, then I think his take always was prophylactic vaccination, he wouldn't recommend it, but that if you heard there was an outbreak of meningitis, he said, be the first person in line to get the shot. Now, though, we're having – I think we're actually – is it the CDC that's recommending sort of blanket immunizations now for people of a certain age? That is for, I think, for freshmen who are just going to college, and then also for a younger age group, like around 12 or something like that.
The younger children are currently being recommended to be vaccinated with one particular type of pneumococcal strain for prevention of a number of types of pneumococcal diseases, including meningitis. But the newer recommendations coming out from the CDC are just that, the newest recommendations that are going to be discussed. In many instances, there is some hesitancy to make a new vaccination sort of mandatory. Mm-hmm. A number of folks are already concerned about the number of vaccinations that kids get already. And in general, unless they're required for school, the number of folks who opt for them is usually significantly less. Now, once the state reviews these recommendations, in many instances, if they become a standard recommendation for school, then virtually everybody of school age will get those, because otherwise they're pretty much denied entrance into the school system.
Yeah. Okay, so we're actually not at that point yet where it may be somebody has recommended it, but it's not a requirement.
That's correct.
Oh, okay. Do you think that we will get to that point where it will be required?
Well, the general trend in the pediatric age group is that there are fewer and fewer illnesses that kids come down with. So in the past, you know, if you immunized for measles, mumps, and rubella, you were protecting probably thousands, if not millions, of children from coming down with a particular illness. And so it was probably a fair amount of return for the vaccination effort. You prevented a lot of disease. Meningitis is fortunately a rare illness. Unfortunately, if you come down with it, it can be fatal, or it can certainly leave people with significant neurological problems afterwards. So as the older diseases become less and less common, the focus is on more uncommon illnesses, and you're going to have to vaccinate a lot of people to get a little benefit.
Yeah.
The problem is that you can't identify in advance who it was that would have truly benefited from being immunized.
Yeah. I guess, as you said before, it's sort of the key about this particular thing is that we see it in places where people are living in very close quarters, and
right.
That's why you see it in the military, and that's why you see it in college dorms, and you apparently don't see it in a more widespread kind of way because you got to get people really
right
in together.
Cases otherwise occur sporadically,
yeah.
But again, rarely.
Yeah. Okay. Our guest here this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carle Clinic in Urbana. This is the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Whatever might happen to be on your mind, you are welcome to call 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller to start us off in Savoy, line one.
Hello. Hello, good morning.
Yes.
Thank you. I had two questions, really. One is about flat feet. In general, at what age does the arch begin to develop? Or, you know, when will I know if my son is flat-footed or not, basically?
Early on in life, children have a fair amount of fat in the arch area, so it's not uncommon for their feet to look a little flat. As they grow older, and this is going to be at variable ages, but probably in young childhood, 5 to 6, you're going to start to see more of a definitive arch. The tendency toward flat feet is often a hereditary one. Generally for children doesn't cause any problems, but can be a source of discomfort as people get older, and the lack of support for the arch can make the foot uncomfortable, can sometimes change the way somebody walks, and then that transfers weight and pressure differently to the ankle, knee, and hip. So if somebody at a young age has relatively flat feet, it's probably not going to be the source of much discomfort to them. But in further years, a good arch support for their shoes would probably be helpful.
I see. Okay, thank you. Secondly, my daughter is complaining about reading difficulty. You know, she's saying that she, you know, would like, we want to get her eyes checked for reading and so forth. My question is the best way to go on that, like, you know, these, just the commercial eyeglass places in the community?
Any licensed optometrist, and a number of them do work in commercial settings, should be able to do a very good and thorough eye exam and determine whether there's any significant problem with the vision, at least as it relates to reading.
Uh-huh.
Certainly.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks for the call. Next up, we have someone listening in Champaign. Caller's on line number two. Hello.
Yes, I'm wondering what you can tell me about tinnitus, whether it's an is there any treatment for it? Is it an indicator of anything else?
In most instances, tinnitus, which is the sort of chronic ringing in the ears, is just that, a chronic condition. It sometimes runs in families. It is most commonly due to either previous noise exposure or just growing older. Those are the two most common reasons for people to develop that. In a few instances, there are some other medical syndromes where tinnitus can be part of another illness, but there are usually additional symptoms, significant hearing loss, vertigo, headaches. Tinnitus can follow a high febrile illness where there was high fever. Can follow head injuries. There are medications that can produce this. Most commonly, aspirin in large doses will produce this. But in most instances, it's a fairly chronic, benign condition, though the noise can drive some people crazy. Listening
and there's
to
really
it.
No treatment.
There, you know, if there's an underlying condition that can be identified and treated, the tinnitus may improve. Like if you're taking too much aspirin, you stop the aspirin, it goes away. If you're recovering from an illness, it may get better.
If it's just aging, there's no.
But if it's just aging, there really isn't much to do for it. The general recommendations, you know, commonly people will say, you know, I can hear it and it interferes with me going to sleep. And this is where, you know, they're basically told get a white noise device to sort of mask it. You know, you turn the radio station in between stations so all you get is the fuzz.
Okay.
That sort of thing. There are devices, much like a hearing aid, that can be worn to, again, try and simply mask the noise. People haven't been terribly happy with those. But a good ear exam, a good hearing exam, and you should be able to answer the question as to whether it's related to anything else.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Now, probably even more and more as time goes along, we have a lot of people listening to music through headphones and personal devices of various kinds. And I'm sure probably a lot of people have had the experience of sitting next to somebody who was listening to something with headphones, and it was so loud that you could hear what it was they were listening to. And, of course, you were thinking to yourself, son,
you're going to be deaf later.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, if you're a parent, I'm sure you've had these discussions with your kids. Does listening to loud music over headphones, does it have the potential of causing hearing problems?
Yes. Any chronic exposure to loud noise is a potential problem.
Pardon me while I turn my headphones down.
Most common ones, other than the music, are typically industrial exposures. Farmers around, you know, heavy equipment who aren't wearing earplugs, factory workers, construction guys, people in the military with the big guns, those sorts of things. Loud noise over a period of time can cause damage to the more sensitive parts of the hearing mechanism, and initially leads to what we refer to as high frequency hearing loss. This is probably one of the more common forms of hearing loss, where an individual with this particular problem generally doesn't have any difficulty carrying on a one-on-one conversation with somebody in front of them in a quiet room. But this is somebody who will very commonly say, you know, I went to a cocktail party, there was a lot of background noise, and I was having trouble picking up certain voices. You know, and they say, well, I'm learning to read lips. And and it's those more high-frequency sounds, especially if there's some background noise as distraction, that becomes initially the hard part to pick out. And then it can progressively encroach on the frequencies that are used more for daily conversational speech, and at some point, if you lose enough hearing, you just basically resort to amplification to try and be able to hear, and that's when you go visit your hearing aid supplier and get a good test and check and see if a device will work for you.
Yeah. It's interesting. It seems that there has been a fair amount of research over the past, I don't know how long, maybe 10, 15, 20 years, and asking, is it possible there could be some sort of surgical intervention with people who have hearing problems, some kind of implant, something like that that you can do? Is there anything that really looks good on the horizon in that?
I'm not aware of anything for the, you know, common adult age and noise-related hearing loss other than hearing aids. You may be aware that for children who are profoundly hearing impaired, cochlear implants have been used with really phenomenal success in a number of instances in terms of allowing them to hear enough to then be able to comprehend and generate useful speech, which was always a problem with deaf children, because you learn to speak by imitating what you hear. And when they couldn't hear, they had a hard time with their speech. We're actually quite fortunate in this community. Dr. Novak at the Carl Ear, Nose, and Throat Department is one of the leading experts in cochlear implants.
Yeah, I know he was a long time ago. It hasn't been a long time, but he actually was on the program mm-hmm. that we talked about. And I think he was doing it at a point where not very many other people were doing it.
Right. And yeah. He has probably some of the most experience of anybody in the United States.
Yeah. Our guest here this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month, he's here on this program for this show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And if you have health questions, could be for yourself, could be for somebody in your family. He deals with people of all ages, children, adults. So give us a call, and I know he will do his best to respond to your question. Here in Champaign, Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have some other callers. We get them lined up, and we'll be with them in a second. One thing I thought I would ask you about is flu. Last fall, we were talking about this quite a bit, and the big story in the news was that there was not enough vaccine for everyone who wanted to get a shot to get one. Although the word was that for the people in the high-risk groups, that there should be enough for them. So we said on this show, other physicians said, if you're in the high-risk category, please go and get your flu shot. If not, there's not too much we can do other than, you know, give you the basic stuff on how to try to keep healthy. And so that's where we are. And apparently things haven't really been too bad, at least to date. Are we at the peak? Are we actually past what would be the normal peak of flu?
No. We're about in it now.
Okay. So there's plenty of time to get the flu. So anybody who says to themselves, whew, I made it through the flu season without getting the flu, well, you know, you still might get the flu.
Yes, you can still get the flu, and we see it up through late spring. As a general rule, it's going to take a couple of weeks for the vaccination to become effective. Mm-hmm. So you can't get your flu shot today and expect to be protected tomorrow, but in a couple of weeks you can. The immunization is thought to be effective 3 or 4 months. But not forever. And we are indeed seeing influenza and have patients hospitalized currently with influenza. There are also simply other respiratory illnesses out there as well. So not everything is actually influenza. There are certainly plenty of other viral illnesses that people are coming down with as well. And the flu shot will not necessarily prevent you from getting those.
Well, if you looked across the country nationally, how has the flu season gone so far, just in terms of how many people have it?
I think it's been a pretty average year. Okay. I haven't read of any particular heavy outbreaks, but that we're still talking, you know, tens of thousands of cases.
Well, I know that back in the fall when we were talking about the shortage of the vaccine, there was a concern that depending on how things went, it could be really bad because right. there were a lot of people weren't immunized. And if it turns out that this year is just average, mm-hmm. Or maybe, you know, I suppose if you could, one could hope maybe slightly better than average in the sense of having fewer cases, would you count that? Would you put that up to luck, or would you say that, well, perhaps people might have done something different that would minimize their chances of exposure? Or is it? Or would you just say, well, we were just lucky?
We were lucky. People did the right things. And in terms of, you know, what we, you know, it's no fun to get the flu. So I don't mean to minimize that. But the real drive to immunize is to prevent significant morbidity and mortality. Influenza, quote, on an average year, causes 35,000 deaths. So, but these primarily occur in that high-risk population. So that's really what we're trying to avoid. You know, if you get the flu and you're otherwise relatively young and healthy, it's not a pleasant experience, but you're not going to die from it. You're probably not going to end up in the hospital. If you're in that high risk group, a bad case of influenza could indeed be fatal, and that's what we're really trying to avoid.
So if you are in the high risk group and you have and you still hadn't gotten the shot for whatever reason,
You still can. You sure can.
Okay. Very good. Let's talk with some more callers here. Lines are full. We'll start with Champagne and line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
When I was younger, I had quite a few tonsil infections, and one of my tonsils became kind of permanently scarred, and there's a little pocket above it where food will stick. And the problem is, well, I've mentioned this to my doctor. He's kind of like, well, just gargle. But food really does stick in there. It gives me horrible, horrible breath. And so it's kind of embarrassing. I work closely with other people. And what I was wondering is there any kind of operation, like would removing the tonsil help this, or is this a condition that I've just got to deal with?
No, you're exactly right. Removing the tonsil would take care of that.
Okay.
The question you have to answer, is it a big enough problem to warrant undergoing surgery? Your doctor's advice to gargle, or the other little trick is if you have a water pick, using that to literally hose that spot and irrigate it out so that you keep it from accumulating food is the other trick that's sometimes used. What you describe is not terribly uncommon. We see it fairly frequently. But you would really need to have a serious discussion with one of the surgeons about what are the potential risks of operation, which is, all of the same risk for any operation. You could have a bad reaction to the anesthetic. There could be an unfortunate bleeding complication. So you need to basically say, this is a serious enough problem that I'm willing to undergo the risks of surgery, and talk to them, because otherwise there really isn't any, there isn't any diet or medication or exercise that anybody's going to give you to fix that. It's a mechanical problem, and it really has a mechanical solution.
Is there anything as far as diet that where one kind of food would be more likely to cause this problem than another, or?
No, not necessarily at all.
Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right,
okay.
Thank you for the call. Well, the next person up here is in Flossmoor on our toll-free line, line four.
Oh,
hello.
Yes. Dr. Schweringen.
Good morning.
Good morning. My husband, well, I've noticed this over a period of time in the car. He'll shake his fingers, he'll shake his fingers like they're tingling. And I've seen him do it in the house lately, watching TV. And in the last couple of months, he's broken two glasses and a glass cookie jar. And I said to him, we both have hypertension. We both go to the doctor every 3 months. I said, did you say anything to Dr. Wong about that? Well, there's nothing wrong with me, he says. Now, that's my question. Might there be something wrong with him? He's 78.
A variety of potential diagnoses come to mind. You mentioned the driving. Is he the one driving at the time?
Yeah.
And
so he's holding on to the steering wheel.
Right. And in that position, when you have your hands up and your wrists slightly bent, especially if you do that for a prolonged period of time.
Yeah, like driving down to Champaign.
Right. This is a position that for a number of individuals will aggravate any tendency toward carpal tunnel syndrome. And people often get that, gee, my hand feels like it's going to sleep. They feel numb and tingly, and then they kind of sort of shake them to kind of wake them up.
I see.
And that's a fairly common problem. Could be a very easy explanation for that. Now,
well,
there
he
are
doesn't type or anything much. He uses a computer. So.
Right. And there are some other medical conditions that can be associated with carpal tunnel, things like rheumatoid arthritis or an underactive thyroid.
Uh-huh.
There are some other illnesses that can be associated with carpal tunnel besides just the physical pressure on the wrist. Other neurological problems associated more with tremor rather than the voluntary shaking.
No, it isn't tremor.
Okay. I think it would be perfectly reasonable to mention it to his physician because in many instances it has a very easy resolution. Mild carpal tunnel often responds well to splinting at the wrists and doesn't require any medication.
Well, that won't fly with him. I know better than that.
Okay.
There isn't anything else, though.
As I said, other than mentioning it to his physician so he can check to see if there are any other associated conditions, I think that'd be the first place to start.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Let's go to line number two next. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning, Dr. Swearinger.
Good morning.
You were talking a moment ago about the flu vaccinations, and with regard to one of them, the flu mist, there was a rather sharp age cutoff in the recommended age, and I was wondering why people 50 and older were not recommended, and whether or not that was just test range where they had verified that it worked on younger people, or if this was a contraindicated age range or what?
Actually, to the best of our knowledge, there really wasn't a contraindication. And you're correct, there's kind of a gap. The flu mist was good for folks up to the age of 50, and the flu vaccination, in terms of the shot, was recommended for those 65 and older. So there was this kind of group in between that supposedly, when there was a shortage, weren't going to get anything. To the best of our knowledge, the flu mist was simply tested on an age range up to age 50, and they did not have FDA approval to say that it was okay in individuals older than that. Now, to the best of our knowledge, we don't have any information that indicates that it would necessarily be a problem, but we also don't have formal testing and approval to say that it is recommended for the age group between 50 and above.
I was wondering about that because I sort of fall into that gap age,
right,
and I finally did persuade my physician to let me have it, but it wasn't easy.
And this came down to, you know, individual discussions between, you know, physicians and their patients as to whether it was a worthwhile thing to do or not. The important part was that, you know, patients needed to understand that it wasn't formally approved, but the information that we had was that it wasn't necessarily contraindicated either.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're
okay.
Welcome.
Thanks for the call. Let's see. Next caller is in Indiana. Line number three.
Hello. I've received contradictory answers in regard to pneumonia shot that you can get along with the shot for the flu, which I received. I talk about how intelligent I am. I just happened by accident to say, well, why don't I just go ahead and get it? And it turned out they only had 150 shots in the community I live in. The line I was in was the line, and they had to cancel everything else. These are done through a supermarket over here. This outfit came up from Georgia to do that, were nurses and stuff. But they mentioned the pneumonia shot and that I should go ahead and get it because Medicare takes care of it. I said, well, heck yes, you know, that's fine. Then I was told at the beginning of the line, more or less, that this is the only time you'll have to do it after you take it when you're 65. There's no need to take it any other time later in your life. And then at the end of the line, another nurse says, now you can take this every 5 years. And I would suggest, you know, 5 years from now that you do it again. And that sort of confused me. And I was wondering if you know why that confusion was said that way or what. And secondly, I was wondering, just sort of brushing up on my common knowledge of years ago, was told that the reason why elderly people don't have colds is that they've gone through all the viruses that cause colds. And I wonder if that was, I don't know if that was a viable theory then, but it was, in the group I ran around with, it seemed to satisfy everybody. I just wonder if that's, you know, sort of the medical view right now. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
You're welcome. Regarding the pneumococcal vaccination, the caller is correct. It is recommended routinely for all adults over the age of 65. and in that setting only needs to be given once. If you are deemed to be a high-risk individual and you received your immunization prior to the age of 65, it is indeed recommended to be updated periodically. And there have been differences of medical opinion anywhere from 5 to 10 years. After your original one, you should get another one. But the standard recommendation is after the age of 65, just once. As for the elderly not having colds, that certainly hasn't been my clinical experience. They seem to get their share, though there is some truth to the fact that as you get exposed and build up some immunity, you're perhaps a little less likely to come down with everything that's going through the community, but they're certainly not resistant to all of them.
Now, I could answer the second question, but I won't let you be the doctor. That's very interesting. I've never heard someone suggest that once you got to be a senior, one of the benefits was, well, you see, you've been exposed to everything, and you're not going to get a cold because all of the various viruses you could have been exposed to, you have been exposed to. So, no colds. Sorry, not true. That's the deal is that there are so many different viruses, and they keep changing all the time that you could get. I mean, that's why you can get a cold 10 times a year.
Right. If sufficiently exposed to
Exactly right. And we will never, there will never be a vaccine for the common cold.
Well, they keep trying, but there literally are so many different things to cover in a vaccine that it's very, very difficult.
All right. Very good. Danville is the next caller here. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. I had in December a colonoscopy and an endoscopy, and the finding was spastic diverticular disease, and for the endoscopy, pre-pyloric subacute gastritis. I hope I said that right.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, I'm so often so nauseated, and I'm so careful what I'm eating. I'm calling really about a nausea, especially mornings.
And what have you been doing for it so far?
Well, so far I take maybe, I take Bentil, for instance. Bentil,
mm-hmm.
And then I take sometimes Imodium. And really, I take nothing for the nausea, maybe Dramamine or something. Doesn't seem to help.
Have you been tried on any of the medications specifically for acid in your stomach?
Well, I take Axit.
And any of the other medications in the class of drugs referred to as proton pump inhibitors? This is Prilosec, Prevacid.
No.
Anything along those lines?
No.
Okay. The medications that you've described, the Bentil is primarily for the muscular spasms in the intestinal tract. The Imodium is to minimize diarrhea.
Right, yeah. I take this, not constantly, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Axit is a medication to help decrease acid production, but there are stronger medications than what you're currently on.
And you think it could cause nausea that way?
Very commonly. You've had enough irritation in your stomach, and that's typically from excess acid.
Oh, and what did you recommend?
Well, there are two medications that are commonly used. One is Prilosec. And
Prilosec?
It's available over the counter.
Prilosec?
Prilosec.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And the other one is Prevacid, and you would need a prescription from your physician for that one.
Prevacid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, at the time of your endoscopy, they probably did a test to look for a particular bacteria called H. pylori. And I would suggest that you talk to your doctor about what that test result was.
Okay. H. pylori.
Right. And in many instances, if H. pylori is present, antibiotics to eradicate it will significantly decrease a lot of these stomach symptoms.
Uh-huh. Okay, I talked to him about H. pylori.
P-Y-L-O-R-I.
P-Y-L-O-R-I. R-I.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We'll try this.
All right.
Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We have about 15 minutes left on the program here. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and every other month he is on the program. It's always a Monday, the 11 o'clock hour. We call it Talk to the Family Doctor because that's the idea. If you have a question, call in. He will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good. Anywhere that you can hear us, if you're calling a long distance, would be a long distance call for you, use the toll-free line. We'll pay for it, 800-222-9455.
I just wanted to follow up on that last caller's questions. I think the presence of H. pylori, the bacteria associated with ulcer disease, is something that's really become more common in terms of knowledge in the last few years. Prior to that, it was many times thought that ulcers were due to, you know, bad diet and stress and too much acid, and there were a variety of things that were tried for that, and yet it seemed to be frequently a recurrent problem. What has been found since the discovery of H. pylori and efforts made to eradicate it when present has been that the prevalence of recurrent ulcer disease has gone way, way down. Mm-hmm. So in many instances, somebody who chronically suffered with ulcers in the past, if they can be identified as being positive for H. pylori, appropriately treated, in many instances, they don't have trouble with recurrent ulcer disease anymore.
Mm-hmm. To do that, do you have to do endoscopy?
No, actually not. The bacteria itself lives in the intestinal tract, and there are a variety of ways to identify whether it's present. The bacteria itself produces certain substances that are exhaled. There's a test, a breath test, for the presence of H. pylori. Yeah. And there's also simply collecting a stool specimen and having the lab identify whether that particular bacteria is present. There's a blood test that can be used to identify whether you've been exposed or had H. pylori. The difficulty with the blood test is it doesn't tell you necessarily whether you have it right this minute. It can tell you whether you've ever been exposed to H. pylori in the past. Mm-hmm. But the stool test is probably useful in the sense that if it's positive to begin with, you treat somebody and they're well, a follow-up study is indeed negative. The blood test will stay positive for quite some time.
How well, if you have somebody who presents with the ulcer symptoms and you do the test and you find that they do have this H. pylori, and so you go ahead and treat that, and part of the treatment is antibiotics, mm-hmm. and you take care of that, what are the chances that that would recur? Or if you do it one time, can you pretty much say that person will, you know, we can, you know, there's no guarantees in medicine, but we
right.
can say there's a good chance that we can, that you will be ulcer free now.
That's correct.
So really, one time the course
yes.
of treatment is pretty good. You don't
yes.
have people coming back.
Generally not.
Oh, okay. Next caller here is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a problem with a shaky right hand. I have sometimes trouble writing, sometimes trouble... somebody's using a vacuum. When I lift a glass or a cup to drink, my hand shakes very much. And when I bring food to my mouth. So what I've learned to do is to eat with my left hand primarily. And I'm wondering, I had injured a shoulder at one time, but through exercise and that sort of thing, I have really quite thoroughly solved that problem. But I'm wondering, why do I have a shaking of one hand and not the other?
Are you right or left-handed?
I'm right-handed.
Are you routinely on any medications?
Yes, I'm on quite a few.
And they are for what type of medical conditions?
Well, arthritic
problems. I've had rheumatic polymyalgia rheumatica, temporal arteritis. I have heart trouble, and I have pseudo gout. So I have all those problems and medicines dealing with them.
And is there any family history of any type of neurological problem?
Not that I know of.
Do you have any pain in the hand?
No.
Any numbness or tingling?
No.
Does the strength of your hand otherwise seem good?
Well, I certainly don't have the strength that I used to have. I am 83 years old, so I don't have the strength that I used to have.
Mm-hmm. But is it the same as the left hand?
I would say probably yes.
Okay. In all likelihood, you may have a focal neurological problem with difficulty in the nerve as it's running down the arm. I seriously doubt whether your previous shoulder problem had anything to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
If you've discussed this with your primary physician and your basic laboratory studies are stable, the next step is probably a formal neurological evaluation. You've obviously adapted to your problem by learning to eat left-handed.
Yeah.
But in terms of identifying the exact cause and potentially giving you some treatment to allow you to be able to use your right hand more functionally, you're going to need some further evaluation, primarily in the neurological arena.
I see. Mm-hmm. All right. So I should talk to my primary physician about that.
I think that'd be a great place to start.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right, thank you. Let's go to Chicago for the next caller here, line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I found one of your caller's comments interesting because 13 years ago, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease. And I took Bentyl, too. They also, when I got nausea, they gave me a total of Bentyl and Reglan, and that seemed to do it for me as far as the nausea was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started having diarrhea real bad, because when you have Crohn's, you have to go to the restroom a lot.
Right.
I took Imodium, and that seemed to help quite a bit.
Right.
I was on prednisone for about 12 years. Last year, my GI specialist wanted me to get off, and I got off. And I noticed that when I got off, my stomach troubles decreased quite a bit. I don't know if that means anything or not.
The prednisone itself can be a problem for your stomach. You are taking it primarily to reduce inflammation.
That's right.
In the other parts of the intestine. But it does have some stomach side effects, and getting off of that would definitely help your stomach.
Yeah, I noticed that when I did leave it. You know, I kept getting in and out of the hospital. I always called the year 2003, the year of the sickness, because it seemed like my stomach was just bouncing up and down every time. And I couldn't even go to the Christmas party we had because of the food. The smell of the food made me nauseous. But then when I got off the prednisone, a lot of the stomach trouble disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't sure whether it was the prednisone that turned on me or not. But
It definitely can contribute to that.
Yeah, because I've heard that it's, you know, when you have active Crohn's, it's good. But after they get the Crohn's under control,
you'd always like to try and minimize that if you can.
Right. I've been off about 13 months. I've always... I guess if there was anything going to happen, it would have happened by now.
Correct.
So I guess I'm just as well without it, I suppose.
We hope you continue to do well.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Someone else wants to call real quick. We could probably get one more call in here before we finish up, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. One thing I might ask you about, just which has been in the news earlier in the month, there was an article that appeared in one of the medical journals. I think it was in New England Journal of Medicine, where someone who was calling for suggesting that essentially all adults in the United States be periodically tested for AIDS. Is that something? How do you see something like happening? He's saying that it should be voluntary, not that it would be a requirement. But I think that the point he was making is that there are a lot of people who have AIDS and who don't know it, and that we would make additional steps in treating and limiting the spread of the disease if we could identify all those unidentified cases. You know, what's your thought about something like that?
In a voluntary sense, certainly any individual who has any potential risk factors for acquiring or transmitting AIDS, it certainly would not be an unreasonable thing to do as part of sort of the standard adult history and physical questions about a person's sexuality and methods of protection from sexually transmitted diseases are routinely asked, and ideally, if those folks are then being appropriately tested, we can help identify. The problem is that the folks who probably have the highest risk behaviors probably aren't accessing the healthcare system. Now, whether the public health departments could be more active in soliciting those folks to come in get tested, you know, is a good question. But I'm not quite sure how you contact the individuals who are going to probably be at highest risk, because they're probably the least likely to come seek medical care.
Yeah. That makes me think of there was a 1 year period here in the state of Illinois about 15 years ago where there was a requirement that anybody who was applying for a marriage license would have to be tested for AIDS.
Right.
And a couple things happened. First of all, the people who could went outside of Illinois to get married. And after a year, all that testing, they decided that they really didn't turn up anybody who was with HIV, or maybe not enough to justify the fact that this this very large number of people was tested,
right.
And then the law was taken off the books.
Right, and it basically points out that you were probably testing a relatively low-risk population. Yeah, assuming, making some assumptions that, you know, two people getting married are now sort of monogamously involved with each other, that's probably a low-risk population compared to other populations.
Yeah.
And so essentially we're testing the wrong population.
We'll try and get one more caller here. Tremont, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The lady with the shaky hand, she's got familial palsy.
She may.
And the medication for that is Mycelene or an alcoholic beverage.
We rarely prescribe those. You're correct. One of the diagnoses that could potentially explain her symptoms would indeed be exactly that. But that is a conclusion that could only actually be reached after an examination.
Well, the doctor told me that if an alcoholic beverage does it, why, that's what it is. If that takes care of it, that's what it is.
All right, well.
But she should know if her other members of her family's had it, because my dad had it, my grandpa had it.
Right, and she said that she did not have any family history of any neurological problems.
Yeah, well, maybe she don't know about it, but.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for the suggestion.
Okay.
We appreciate it. That's got to be, as a physician, one of the best tools you have is asking people, you know, getting as much of their medical history and family's medical history as you possibly can,
yes.
Which may sometimes be real difficult because you're asking people, you know, well, what they remember, what they know. There could be all sorts of things in your health background in terms of your parents and your grandparents and whatever that you just don't know, or maybe you're just kind of vague on.
And in many instances, if you can take a detailed enough history and get the opportunity to do a good physical exam, probably 9 times out of 10, you're going to have a pretty good idea of what the diagnosis is for most common medical conditions. It's just that, as you said at the beginning of the show, without the opportunity to do the exam, it's really not appropriate to reach a conclusion. Certainly this last caller's suggestion is within the realm of possibility, but there are others as well that need to be considered before recommending that she just have a beer.
Okay. Any last thing that you'd like to leave with folks this time around?
I hope everybody stays healthy through the rest of the winter here, and that I think everybody else like me will be looking forward to spring.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And again, if you did not get a flu shot and you're in one of the high-risk categories, which is?
Anybody over the age of 65 or anybody under that with chronic heart or lung disease.
Okay. If you didn't get your shot, you still can. And here in Champaign-Urbana, we still have some vaccine.
Yes.
So talk with your primary care doctor, or you can call the folks at Champaign-Urbana Public Health. Right. And one way or another, look into getting a shot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he's here. It's always on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour for this show we call Talk to the Family Doctor.